Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fascinating legal showdown. Experience Hendrix LLC v. Hendrix Licensing.com LTD. Think of this as your crash course in trademark law, the often debated rights of deceased celebrities, and a genuine clash between how state and federal laws see these things.
Exactly. And for this deep dive, you've given us a great set of materials, podcast guidelines, detailed case briefs, even a perplexity analysis. It's kind of a 360-degree view of this interesting legal battle.
Absolutely. And at the center of it all is the icon Jimi Hendrix and this legal fight over his very identity in the marketplace, his name, his image, everything, really. Our goal today is to cut through the legal jargon, pull out the core insights from these documents. We want to understand the crucial rulings and what they mean, especially if you're maybe thinking about law or already in it. Okay, so let's unpack this.
Right. So to get us started, the plaintiff here was Experience Hendrix LLC and also its subsidiary, Authentic Hendrix LLC. These are the entities that held the trademarks for Jimi Hendrix's name, image, signature, all that. They filed a lawsuit against Andrew Pitsikalis and his company, HendrixLicensing.com.
Okay.
They alleged that Pitsikalis and his company were selling unauthorized merchandise featuring the Hendrix brand.
Right. So we're talking about things like the domain name itself, HendrixLicensing.com, and then Hendrix's likeness showing up on like t-shirts and various products.
Exactly.
The basic argument was that this was creating confusion for consumers. If you see a Hendrix t-shirt online, you might just assume it's official, right?
Precisely. And the initial ruling for the district court actually sided with the Hendrix estate on that trademark infringement claim. They awarded a pretty significant $1.7 million in damages.
Yeah.
But this story takes a turn because the court later reduced this amount quite a bit, down to just $60,000. And, adding another layer, the district court also ruled against the estate by finding Washington State's Personality Rights Act, or WPRA, unconstitutional.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Both sides decided to appeal, right? Pitsikalis was challenging the finding that he was liable for infringement in the first place, basically saying he hadn't done anything wrong.
Mm.
Meanwhile, the Hendrix estate was appealing the drastic cut in damages and also that ruling against the Washington state law.
This sets the stage for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to step in, and they had several key legal questions in front of them. One of the primary issues was whether Pitsikalis' use of Hendrix's name and likeness could be considered what's called nominative fair use.
Nominative fair use. Okay, that's when you use a trademark to refer to the actual goods or services linked with that mark, correct? Mm. Like if I said, this guitar amp is great for playing like Jimi Hendrix, I'm using his name to describe a style, not necessarily saying he endorsed the amp.
That's the idea.
So Pitsikalis was basically arguing he was just referring to Jimi Hendrix.
That's the basic argument, yes. However, the Ninth Circuit didn't agree. They upheld the district court's initial finding of infringement. Their reasoning was that Pitsikalis' use of Hendrix's name, especially in that domain name and across a whole range of merchandise, wasn't really fair.
Okay.
And critically, it was likely to cause consumers to believe there was an official connection or endorsement or affiliation. This really highlights a crucial distinction. Just referring to a trademark is different from using it in a way that suggests sponsorship. The way you use it matters a lot.
Got it. So it wasn't just mentioning Hendrix. It was giving the impression of an official Hendrix-backed product line. Okay. Now, what about the money? That initial $1.7 million the jury awarded, what happened with that on appeal?
Well, the Ninth Circuit actually reinstated that initial jury award. They found there was enough evidence presented to support it.
Mm-hmm.
However, they also agreed with the district court that a new trial was needed specifically on the calculation of those damages, just to make sure there weren't any, improper or duplicated elements in how the jury got to that figure.
Hmm.
So the original amount was back on the table, but the method needed a closer look.
Right, right. And then we have the Washington state law, the WPRA. Why was that such a significant part of this case?
The WPRA grants postmortem publicity rights. This means the right to control the commercial use of a deceased person's name, voice, signature, photo, likeness that can be passed on to their heirs.
Hmm.
The district court had ruled this law was unconstitutional as applied to Hendrix, but the Ninth Circuit reversed that decision. They upheld the WPRA's constitutionality in this context. They emphasized Washington State's legitimate interest in protecting these rights, especially given Hendrix's upbringing and, significant ties to Seattle.
So the key isn't just where someone dies, but their deep roots in a state during their life. That seems Well, it raises questions about precedents for other celebrities with ties to multiple places, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But here, the court found those Washington ties sufficient. So even after his death, Washington had the legal authority to dictate who could commercially profit from his image and name, at least regarding activities impacting the state.
Interesting.
Yes. The court reasoned that because Hendricks had strong connections to Washington, the state had a valid interest. And furthermore, they also rejected Pitsikalis' attempt to get a legal declaration invalidating the WPRA's application to him. So it really solidified the Hendricks estate's rights under that state law.
Okay, let's dig a little deeper into the reasoning behind these key rulings, starting with the trademark issue. Why exactly did the nominative fair use argument fall flat with the Ninth Circuit?
Well, the Ninth Circuit applied a specific three-part test for nominative fair use. The court looks at, one, was it necessary to use the mark? Could they describe their product without it? Two, how much of the mark was used? Was it more than needed? And three, the big one, potential for confusion, were they suggesting sponsorship or endorsement?
Right.
To qualify as nominative fair use, you have to meet all three parts of this test. In Pitsikalis' case, the court found his use went beyond what was necessary just to identify Hendricks. And crucially, it created that strong impression of official endorsement through things like the HendricksLicensing.com domain name and the prominent display of Hendricks' image on lots of different merchandise. It wasn't just saying Hendricks music. It was more like building a brand around him.
Makes sense. And you mentioned there was key evidence that supported the damages claim. What kind of evidence are we talking about here? Because $1.7 million is a lot.
Yes, and that's a really critical takeaway for anyone involved in IP litigation. The court specifically highlighted the importance of concrete evidence of financial harm. In this case, Exhibit 60, which apparently had detailed sales data, showed a significant drop in the plaintiff's licensing revenue. And this drop directly coincided with the defendant's infringing activities starting up. This kind of tangible proof, you know, a direct link between the infringement and actual financial loss, like lost licensing deals, is absolutely crucial if you want substantial damages. Courts are usually pretty hesitant to accept claims of loss based just on speculation. You need facts.
That makes perfect sense. You can't just claim you lost money. You have to show that causal link.
Okay, shifting gears back to the WPRA, how did the Ninth Circuit justify applying it retroactively? I mean, Hendricks passed away before the law was even enacted, right? And how did they deal with concerns it might mess with interstate commerce?
Good questions. The court's justification for the WPRA's application really came down to those state ties we talked about.
They reasoned that Washington State has a legitimate interest in protecting the post-mortem rights of people who had significant connections there during their lifetime, like growing up there, establishing roots, like Hendricks did in Seattle. The fact the law came after his death didn't cancel out Washington's interest in protecting the legacy of someone so closely tied to the state.
Hmm.
Regarding the Dormant Commerce Clause, which, just to quickly clarify, is that legal idea that states can't pass laws that unduly burden interstate commerce laws. The court found no violation there. They reasoned that the WPRA mainly regulates rights within Washington and doesn't inherently discriminate against out-of-state interests. Its impact on nationwide commerce was seen as incidental to its legitimate local purpose.
Got it. And there was a concurring opinion from one of the judges, right? What was the main point that Judge wanted to emphasize?
Yes, Judge Rawlinson. She agreed with the majority on the trademark infringement liability and the constitutionality of the WPRA. But she strongly disagreed with ordering a new trial just for calculating damages.
Oh, interesting. Why?
Her main argument was that the jury's initial $1.7 million award was, in her view, well supported by substantial evidence presented at trial. Things like testimony and documents showing the Hendricks estate's lost profits directly because of Pitsikalis' infringing activities. She felt the district court, and by extension the majority on this point, had kind of overstepped by second-guessing the jury's assessment of the facts related to damages. It really underscores this ongoing tension in the legal system. You know, how much deference should appellate courts give to a jury's findings of fact, especially when it's about complex stuff, like calculating financial damages in IP cases?
So for someone trying to make sense of all this, maybe a law student listening in, what are the most important things to take away from this experience Hendricks case?
Okay, yeah. Firstly, regarding trademark law, this case is a strong reminder that the nominative fair use defense is interpreted pretty narrowly. You can't just use someone else's trademark to sell your stuff if that use is likely to confuse consumers about endorsement or affiliation. The way you use the mark really matters. Secondly, proving damages in IP cases. You absolutely need clear, compelling, preferably quantifiable evidence directly linking the infringement to actual financial harm. Exhibit 60 here is a perfect example of the kind of concrete proof courts want. And, also important, if you have multiple claims, like federal trademark and state rights, be careful not to get awarded damages twice for the same basic harm. No double dipping.
Makes sense. And from the perspective of state law and those personality rights?
Well, this case strongly supports the idea that states do have the power to protect postmortem publicity rights for celebrities, especially when there are significant ties between the celebrity and that state like growing up there. The Washington WPRA, even being applied retroactively, was found constitutional in this specific situation. And finally, Judge Rawlinson's concurrence is a good reminder about the jury's role in assessing facts, and that courts should generally hesitate to overturn those findings unless there's a really clear legal error.
Okay, this has been a really insightful deep dive into, yeah, a complex but definitely fascinating area of law. So just to recap quickly, we've looked at trademark infringement under the Lanham Act, the tricky business of calculating damages, and the constitutionality of Washington's Personality Rights Act.
Mm.
We saw the Ninth Circuit uphold the infringement finding, reinstate that big initial jury damages award, though, yes, ordering a new trial on the calculation part, and they affirmed the WPRA's constitutionality for Hendricks. That rejection of nominative fair use is a key point.
Definitely.
As is the absolute need for solid evidence like Exhibit 60 for damage claims. And that idea that states can protect postmortem publicity rights based on significant connections like Hendricks's upbringing in Seattle, that's a big deal. Plus, yeah, Judge Rawlinson's concurrence adds that important perspective on judges versus juries.
Absolutely. What's particularly interesting here, I think, is how federal trademark law and state-level personality rights protections interact, and how the court navigated those different legal systems.
Yeah, exactly. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's maybe a thought for you, our listeners, to ponder. Given our increasingly digital world, right, where likenesses and legacies of deceased people can be replicated and monetized in totally new ways, think AI, deepfakes, how might these legal principles around publicity rights and trademark law need to adapt? Will state laws alone be enough? Or might we need more unified federal approaches to balance protecting a legacy with, you know, fair competition and free expression? It's a really complex and fast-moving area that's definitely going to keep generating interesting legal questions. Thanks for exploring the depths of this case with us.